So right now, I mean, somewhere in the world, an amateur hockey player is skating toward the boards to retrieve a loose puck.
Yeah, happens thousands of times a day.
Right. And they're moving slowly, like maybe just at walking speed. But they hear the scrape of skates behind them, and in a split second, they make this one completely natural but subtle mistake.
They tuck their chin.
Exactly. They tuck their chin toward their chest. And if the player behind them finishes a check, that walking speed impact against the boards is literally enough to shatter their cervical spine.
It's a terrifying reality of the sport, and I think it completely shatters the illusion we often have about how injuries actually occur on the ice.
Oh, for sure. Because we picture, high-speed open ice collisions between these massive professional athletes.
Right. But the physics of the human body, and particularly the spine, tell a very different story. A story where the mechanics of how you carry yourself actually matter far more than how fast you're skating.
Which is such a massive paradigm shift. Because usually, when we think about a winning hockey team, there's this expectation of pure sweeping beauty.
The highlight reel stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You picture these flawless passing plays, the puck moving end to end on a string, the crowd roaring as it snaps into the top corner. We want the game to be this elegant, frictionless test of pure skill.
But the moment you step onto the actual ice, that highlight reel just vanishes.
It really does. The competitive landscape is a grind. It is scrappy. Because the core truth we are exploring today is that most hockey games are not decided by those beautiful open ice passing plays.
No, not at all.
They're won in the brutal 3-second contests for a loose puck along the wall, in the corners, and at the front of the net.
It's the absolute definition of warfare in the trenches, and that really brings us to the core mission of this deep dive.
Right.
We are going to deconstruct and master the art of physical play, body contact, and those critical battles in hockey.
And the objective here isn't merely to survive those battles, right?
Yay. Exactly. The goal is to dominate them, to win the puck, and to do so without getting hurt, without injuring an opponent, and, without ending up in the penalty box or getting ejected.
Because the stakes couldn't be higher. I mean, a single misunderstanding of the rules or just one slight mistake in body mechanics can result in those severe spinal injuries we just mentioned.
Or on the disciplinary side, a complete misread of your league's rulebook can result in match penalties that literally end your season.
So, okay, let's unpack this. We are going to build your mental model from the ground up today. We'll start with the fundamental rules of engagement, basically mapping out the matrix of what is legally allowed.
Yeah, and from there, we'll layer on non-contact defensive tools, escalate into the mechanics of legal body checking, cover those non-negotiable safety mechanisms for receiving a hit, and finally apply all of this to specific battle zones.
Sounds like a master class. But to truly master this, we can't just memorize a list of rules. We have to understand the why behind them.
Absolutely. Before you can learn the physical techniques of engagement, you absolutely must build an ironclad understanding of what game you are actually playing. The rules dictate the biomechanics.
Okay, so what's the foundation?
The most fundamental distinction you need to internalize is the difference between body contact and body checking.
Those terms get thrown around interchangeably by fans and even broadcasters all the time.
Oh, constantly. But from a legal and structural standpoint, they are entirely different species of physical engagement. Let's start with body contact.
Okay.
This is essentially the unavoidable physics of two objects trying to occupy the same space while moving. It's incidental or positional contact.
So it happens when two players are both pursuing the puck, skating in the same general direction.
Right. They might lean on each other, rub shoulders, or one might box the other out to establish position. And the crucial piece of information for you to retain here is that this type of body contact is legal everywhere.
Literally everywhere.
Yes. It is legal at every single age level in every single division across the globe. You are entirely within your rights to hold your ground.
But body checking is a completely different mechanism, right?
Totally different. Body checking is a deliberate, intentional act. It is using your mass and your momentum to forcibly separate an opponent from the puck.
So you're no longer just occupying space, you are actively attacking their space.
Exactly. And here's the major takeaway. Body checking is legal only in highly specific, designated leagues.
This is where we need to look closely at the governing rule books, because assuming you know the rules based on your age or your skill level is just a recipe for a season-ending suspension.
Oh, 100%. Let's break down USA Hockey first. Under their umbrella, there is absolutely no checking at the 12U level, meaning 12 years old and under and below.
I want to pause on that 12-year rule because understanding the why is just fascinating to me. USA Hockey didn't just pick age 12 out of a hat.
No, they didn't.
When you look at the research on brain development and skill acquisition, the window before puberty is critical for developing fine motor skills, edge work, and spatial awareness.
Right. And if a 10-year-old is constantly terrified of getting blown up in open ice, their brain enters survival mode.
Exactly. They stop looking for passes. They stop trying creative stick handling. They just chip the puck away to avoid getting hit. By removing checking at those vital developmental ages, the governing body forces players to actually learn the game of hockey rather than just playing bumper cars.
That is a phenomenal point. The rule is engineered to build better, more highly skilled players.
Yeah.
USA Hockey also mandates no checking in all girls and women's classifications and in all non-check adult recreational leagues.
Okay, that makes sense.
Furthermore, they explicitly ban body checking in all blind hockey games, regardless of the age or size of the players on the roster.
Which, again, makes total sense when you think about the mechanics of a hit. To safely receive a body check, your brain needs visual cues to prepare your muscles to brace for impact. If an athlete is visually impaired, they are deprived of that anticipation window. So a hit that might just bruise a sighted player could cause catastrophic whiplash for a blind player because their musculature just hasn't locked down to absorb the kinetic energy.
Precisely. The visual input is a prerequisite for physical safety. Now, if we move north to Hockey Canada, the landscape shifts slightly.
Okay, how so?
Under their rules, there is no checking at U13 and below. There is no checking in female hockey. But they add a very interesting bureaucratic clause. Checking is also banned in, quote, any other division approved by a member of Hockey Canada.
So age alone is not a reliable indicator.
Not at all.
Just because a kid turns 14 and clears the U13 bracket doesn't magically grant them the right to start throwing their shoulders around. A local league or a specific division can simply decide they are a non-check league.
Right. You have to actively investigate what your specific local board has approved. And this ambiguity becomes even more pronounced in adult recreational hockey.
Oh, beer leagues.
Yeah, exactly. A massive percentage of adult leagues operate under CARAS, the Canadian Adult Recreational Hockey Association. If you play in a CARAS-affiliated league, there is absolutely no checking division. It does not exist.
Wow, not at all.
None. A deliberate body check is an automatic minor or major penalty anywhere on the ice. If you happen to injure someone with that check, it elevates to an automatic major.
And those have serious consequences, right?
Yeah. In that specific rule book, a major penalty means you are ejected for the remainder of the game and suspended for the next one. On top of that, if you accumulate 3 penalties of any kind, like 3 simple tripping or hooking calls, you are automatically ejected.
3 strikes and your night is over. They are actively engineering the danger out of the beer leagues.
Yeah, they really are.
And for our listeners across the pond, the UK and Britain mostly operate on the IIHF base rule book, which is then amended by local in-house rules.
Right.
But here is the wild part. Neither the IIHF nor the British local books set a stated universal age for when checking becomes legal. You literally cannot look it up in the central index.
That's crazy.
Yeah, you have to consult your specific league administrators and get it in writing. And a crucial note for British women's hockey, the adult classification starts at age 14, and any major penalty guarantees an automatic game misconduct and an ejection.
All of these overlapping, highly specific jurisdictions create a massive common misconception that we really need to clear up.
What's that?
Well, players will often join an adult rec league and think, you know, well, the rule book says this is a non-check league, so I'm playing in a protective bubble. The referee is going to blow the whistle the second somebody touches me.
I see this constantly. A player gets leaned on in the corner, loses their balance, and immediately throws their hands up, screaming at the ref for a penalty, completely misunderstanding what they actually signed up for.
It is a fundamental misunderstanding of the physics of the sport. Non-check does not equal non-contact.
Right.
USA Hockey actually goes out of its way to specifically call these divisions competitive contact leagues. They explicitly note that this category of the game can be incredibly physical.
So you are still battling for position. You are still leaning your body weight onto an opponent. You are still sealing people off against the wall.
Exactly. The referee is not there to ensure you have 3 feet of personal space.
Let me throw a practical, real-world scenario at you to test the boundaries of these rules.
Sure, let's hear it.
Let's say I'm coaching a checking team, right? A U15 boys travel team that hits every weekend. We enter a holiday tournament, and due to a scheduling quirk, we end up playing a team that is registered as a non-checking team. Whose rules win? Does my checking team get to play our normal game?
No, and the rule books anticipate this exact friction. Under USA Hockey Rule 604B, the answer is definitive. If a checking team plays a non-checking team, body checking is prohibited outright for the entire game, for everybody on the ice.
So the safest, most restrictive rule always acts as the lowest common denominator.
Exactly. So, to synthesize this foundational layer for you listening, you must draw a hard mental line between incidental contact, which is the legal physics of two players vying for space, and deliberate checking, which is the restricted act of forceful separation.
And you must never assume your league's rules based on your age or your skill level. You need to verify it before you ever lace up your skates.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've mapped the matrix. We know what game we are legally allowed to play. Now we have to actually step on the ice and defend.
Right.
If I'm playing in a non-check league, or if I'm just in a situation where throwing a hit would pull me out of position, what are my tools? We need to build the foundation of defense.
And we start with the primary master tool that is completely legal in every single league at every single age level across the world. We are talking about angling.
Angling. If you want to understand elite defensive hockey, you really have to understand angling.
It is the absolute bedrock of spatial control. To define it mechanically, angling is the art of steering an opponent to bad ice, which almost universally means the boards, by deliberately choosing your skating route.
So you are not attacking the player, you're attacking the space around the player.
Yes, you are closing the gap so tightly and at such a specific angle that they have absolutely no room to cut back to the middle of the ice.
Because the middle of the ice is the good ice. That's where the slot is, that's where the shooting angles open up, and that's where goals are scored.
Exactly.
The best analogy for this is a sheepdog herding sheep into a pen.
Oh, I love that analogy.
Yeah. If you watch a highly trained border collie working a flock, the dog doesn't just sprint directly at the sheep and tackle them. If it did that, the sheep would scatter in 100 different directions and it would be total chaos.
Right.
Instead, the dog uses its raw speed to get ahead of the flock, and then it uses its route and its body positioning to take away all the wrong spaces, forcing the sheep to go exactly where the dog wants them to go. As a defender, you are the sheepdog. The puck carrier, the sheep. The boards are the pen.
That analogy perfectly captures the psychology of angling. You are dictating their path by denying them alternatives. And to do this effectively on the ice, there is a very specific four-step mechanical process. If you miss any of these steps, the sheep escapes the pen.
Okay, let's walk through those steps. What is step one?
Step one is the route. You must skate at the ice the puck carrier wants to occupy, not at the player themselves. This is the most common mistake beginners make. They lock eyes on the logo on the attacker's chest and skate straight at them like a homing missile.
Which is a disaster if the attacker has even a baseline level of puck handling skill. I mean, if I skate directly at you, all you have to do is pull the puck across your body, take one hard stride to the inside, and I am going to go flying right past you into the corner, completely out of the play.
Exactly. You have to anticipate where they want to go. If they are on the wing and they want to cut to the middle, you skate to the middle to take that ice away before they get there.
Okay, so that's the route. What's step two?
Step two is momentum. Your approach route must leave you traveling on an angle that carries you back toward your own net. You should never be skating flat, horizontally across the ice to intercept someone.
Why is that horizontal angle so dangerous?
Because it destroys your defensive posture if you make a mistake. If you angle flat across the ice, perpendicular to the boards, and the forward is faster than you think, or they manage to chip the puck off the glass and past you, you are now dead in the water.
Because your momentum has carried you to the boards, and the forward is already behind you.
Exactly. They're on a breakaway toward your goalie. But if your momentum is carrying you backward on a diagonal toward your net, even if you miscalculate and get beaten, you are still physically above them. Your body remains between the puck and your goal, and you can recover.
That is brilliant. It's about engineering failure tolerance into your defensive mechanics. You're assuming you might get beaten and positioning yourself so that if you do, it isn't fatal to your team. Okay, what is step three?
Step three is speed control. You cannot execute an angle at maximum velocity. As the gap between you and the puck carrier shrinks to a few feet, you need to slow your feet down, drop your hips, and keep your knees deeply bent. And here is a crucial mechanical rule that often surprises people. Do not cross over your skates as you close that final gap.
That seems totally counterintuitive. I mean, we are taught from day one that crossovers generate speed and power. Why would I stop crossing over right when I need to catch the guy?
Because crossovers require you to commit your center of mass. When you cross one skate over the other, your weight shifts entirely to outside of your normal base of support. You are locked onto a specific trajectory for that split second.
Right.
A smart, elite attacker is watching your feet. The exact millisecond they see you commit to a crossover, they will immediately plant their foot and cut back hard against the grain. Because your legs are literally tied in a knot, you cannot pivot to stay with them. You will blow a tire or just stumble past them.
Wow.
By keeping your skates on the ice, riding an inside edge with a wide base, you maintain the biomechanical ability to pivot instantly in any direction.
So, rote is aimed at their intended ice. Momentum is carrying you defensively back toward your net. Speed is controlled, utilizing inside edges rather than crossovers. What finishes the trap? What is step four?
Step four is your stick. As you close that final gap, your stick needs to be flat on the ice, sweeping in a wide arc. You are using your body mass to take away the physical skating lane to the outside along the wall, and you are using your stick blade to take away the passing lane to the inside.
You're creating an inescapable funnel. They can't skate through your body and they can't pass through your
Yes,
stick.
yeah.
And this entire sheepdog philosophy relies heavily on another core concept of the rule book, which is body position. Let's dig into Rule 56.1 because it empowers defenders in a profound way.
Rule 56.1, which is remarkably consistent across all major rule books, essentially states that you are legally entitled to the ice you are currently occupying.
Okay.
You have zero obligation to move out of the way to let an opponent proceed. You can legally block an opponent's path, bringing them to a complete halt, provided you are in front of them and you are both moving in the same general direction.
This reminds me so much of boxing out for a rebound in basketball. If I beat you to the spot under the hoop, I own that cylinder of space. You can't just run me over.
Exactly the same principle.
In non-checking hockey leagues, mastering this rule is a superpower. You don't have to throw a violent hit to stop someone. Simply standing in the exact place your opponent needs to be is a complete 100% legal defensive maneuver.
But the rule books place very strict limitations on how you maintain that position. What you absolutely cannot do is use your stick to make your physical footprint wider.
Right.
If you hold your stick out parallel to the ice to clothesline someone or block their waist, that is an immediate interference penalty. Furthermore, you cannot use your free hand to grab their jersey, pull their arm, or hold their hip.
I think USA Hockey does have a slight nuance where they allow you to fend off an opponent with a free arm, right?
They do, but the conditions are incredibly strict.
Yeah.
You must already be in physical control of the puck, or actively reaching to play a loose puck, and you cannot use that free arm to violently push off and artificially create space.
Let's lock this concept in with a practical retrieval question for you listening. Imagine the scenario. You are defending on the rush. You've tried to angle the attacker, but they are just faster than you.
Yeah.
They beat you to the outside, and you completely lose your body position.
Okay.
They're now a half stride ahead of you. According to the rules of hockey, what is the single only legal method available to you to get that body position back?
The only legal method is to move your feet and skate harder than they do. If you panic and reach out with your stick blade to tug at their waist, the referee is calling you for hooking. If you reach out with your free hand to grab their elbow, you are getting called for holding. The moment you lose positional leverage, your legs are your only legal asset.
All right, so let's assume the angle worked perfectly. You steered them into the boards, you matched their speed, you didn't cross over, and your body position is flawless. They are trapped against the glass.
The sheep is in the pen.
Exactly. But they still have the puck on their blade. Your body has done its job, but now we have to actually perform the extraction without taking a penalty. How do we take the puck away? We are moving from the macro control of the sheepdog to the micro precision of a surgeon or a scalpel. We need to talk about stick checks.
This is where defensive play becomes an art form. Angling takes the body and denies the ice. The stick check safely and cleanly removes the puck. Our sources highlight four primary stick checks that every player needs to master. The first and most fundamental is the poke check.
Let's visualize the mechanics of a proper poke check. Because a lot of people get this wrong.
Yeah.
You are not lunging.
Not at all.
Think of a boxer throwing a stiff defensive jab while trying to stay perfectly on balance. The poke check is a short, sharp, straight extension of your blade directly at the puck. Your top hand stays anchored near your hip or your chest, acting as the fulcrum. You push the shaft forward with your bottom hand.
And the crucial part here is the recovery. Because you haven't thrown your entire center of gravity forward, if you miss that puck, your feet are still underneath you. You can pull the stick back and keep skating.
But if you lunge from your waist and you miss,
you are practically swimming on the ice while the puck carrier walks right around you.
That balances everything. So the second tool is the sweep check. Geometrically, this looks very different.
Yeah, you get low, extend your stick out, and sweep the shaft and blade in a wide, low arc, keeping it nearly parallel to the ice surface.
This isn't usually for stripping a puck directly off a guy's stick in tight quarters, right?
Yeah, exactly. The sweep check is primarily a space denial tool. You use it when you are defending a two-on-one rush to take away the passing lane across the slot, or when an attacker has beaten you slightly to the outside and you need to disrupt their ability to pull the puck back to the middle. It covers a massive amount of square footage on the ice.
And what happens when things get claustrophobic? Say you are in a face-off or a tight net front scrum, and there's no room to swing or poke.
That is where you use the third tool, which is the press down. Some coaches call it the stick press. It relies entirely on physical leverage. You take the lower shaft or blade of your stick, place it forcefully on top of their stick blade, and pin it flat against the ice.
So if their blade cannot move, they cannot shoot, and they cannot receive a pass, you are essentially neutralizing their weapon.
Exactly. But all of our sources agree that the real star of the show, the absolute master tool of defensive hockey, is the fourth technique, the stick lift.
I really want to dig into the physics and the rulebook implications of this one, because it is incredibly powerful.
What is genuinely fascinating about the stick lift is that it is arguably the single most effective defensive play in amateur and adult hockey, yet it is almost entirely absent from beginner instruction.
It really is.
When a novice player realizes they are getting beaten and they need to strip a puck, their instinct is to reach, to hack, to hook, or to cross-check, and all of those instincts lead straight to the penalty box.
So what are the exact biomechanics of a flawless stick lift? How does it actually work?
It uses the opponent's momentum against them. You slide the toe of your blade underneath the lower shaft of their stick, and you snap your wrists to lift crisply and directly straight up toward the rafters.
Okay, straight up.
Yes. You do not pull sideways, because that becomes a hook. You lift vertically. This pops their blade completely off the ice and leaves the puck sitting there unprotected. You then step through the space you just created and take the puck with your free hand still securely on your stick.
And from a postural standpoint, it is incredibly safe for the defender. You haven't committed your shoulders or your hips into a hit. You remain perfectly centered over your skates.
But the margins for error are razor thin, and the penalty risks are massive if your geometry is slightly off. There's a very specific target area on the opponent's stick where you are legally allowed to execute this lift.
You have to aim low. You absolutely must lift their stick entirely below their bottom hand. You want to see a clear hands with the space above your blade and below the cuff of their glove.
The reason for this strictness is that the rule books are incredibly protective of players' hands. A hockey glove provides padding, but the bones and the fingers and the wrist are fragile, and a composite stick acts like a lever that can easily cause microfractures.
Right.
Under the IIHF rules, which govern British hockey and international play, if you attempt a stick lift and your stick goes against or even near the opponent's hands, the referee is explicitly instructed to call a hooking penalty.
Think about that. You don't even have to physically pull them backward. Just making contact with the gloves from underneath is defined as a hook in that rule book.
The NHL approaches the same problem from a different angle, utilizing the slashing rule. In the NHL, a forceful chop on or near the hands that isn't a direct attempt to play the puck is penalized as a slash.
And USA Hockey.
USA Hockey takes that NHL framework and removes the leniency. They eliminate the attempt to play the puck loophole entirely. Under USA Hockey, any forceful chop on the hands is a slash, period. Furthermore, if you lift an opponent's hands to the point where it removes their physical ability to shoot or pass the puck, USA Hockey will penalize you for hooking.
So the golden rule is clear. Stay miles away from the gloves. But our sources also detail a specific, highly dangerous scenario regarding the stick lift that often results in major penalties. They call it the danger zone.
The danger zone emerges when you attempt to execute a stick lift on an opponent who is bent deeply over the puck. Imagine a player digging frantically in the corner. Their knees are bent, their chest is parallel to the ice, and their face is just a few feet off the ground.
Okay.
If you try to aggressively lift their stick in that posture and you miss the shaft, the kinetic energy of your lift has nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Your stick blade is going to ride completely unimpeded right up into their face.
Which brings us to the complexities of a high sticking rule.
Yeah.
Let's say I'm a big defenseman, maybe 6'4". The player digging in the corner is 5'4", and they are bent over. Their face is practically down by my kneecaps.
Right.
If I miss the stick lift and my blade hits them in the nose, my stick has really come up to my own waist level.
Is that still legally considered a high sticking penalty?
Yes, it is. And this is a vital piece of the mental model to correct. Players constantly argue with referees, holding their hand at their waist saying, you know, ref, my stick was down here.
Yeah.
But the reference point for a high sticking penalty is never the defender's body.
The legal reference point is the struck player's waist or shoulders. If they are bent over, their legal threshold lowers with them. If you strike their face, you have committed a high stick. Regardless of where your hands were relative to your own body, you are responsible for your stick at all times.
And the consequences for that lack of control are severe. It's not just a polite 2-minute sit in the sin bin.
No, it scales quickly. If your stick draws blood, it elevates to an automatic double minor 4 minutes. But it gets worse. Under USA Hockey and IIHF guidelines, if the referee determines that your action recklessly endangered that player, they can assess a major penalty plus a game misconduct.
That means you were ejected and sent to the locker room.
What?
Even if there was no blood and no injury at all.
Exactly. And in those Curie Adult Rec leagues we discussed earlier, any accidental stick contact above the shoulders is an uncompromising automatic 5-minute major.
So if we take a breath and review sections 2 and 3, we see a complete defensive philosophy for non-checking hockey. Angling takes away the body, the momentum, and the ice. Stick lifts and poke checks safely and legally take away the puck.
Yes.
If you can integrate those two concepts, you will be a dominant elite defender without ever throwing a shoulder. But what if you are playing in a checking league? What if the rules allow you to escalate the physical engagement? This brings us to section 4. The escalation and the mechanics of delivering a legal body check.
To understand how an expert views body checking, we have to look at how USA Hockey structures their teaching progression. They view body checking as the absolute final step of defensive engagement. Step 7 out of 7. Yeah. It is never the first tool you reach for.
So what are the first 6?
The curriculum demands that a player master skating, then angling, then stick checks, then contact, confidence, body blocking, rubouts along the wall, and only then are they permitted to attempt solid open ice body checks.
Which is a profound realization. It means that when you see a player try to absolutely blow someone up at center ice and they miss completely, or they take a horrific interference penalty, it is almost always because they skipped the prerequisite steps. Usually they skipped angling. They just locked eyes on the target and skated straight at them like an unguided missile.
When you skip the angling step, you surrender all spatial control. So let's establish the absolute framework of a legal check. Think of this as a checklist that must be satisfied in milliseconds.
Okay, what's first?
First, what is the fundamental purpose of the hit? The only legally recognized purpose of a body check is to separate the opponent from the puck to gain possession.
The purpose is not to punish, not to send a message, and not to physically intimidate an opponent.
Right. If a referee believes your intent was purely to punish, they will find a penalty to call.
Purpose is possession. Check. Number 2, the target.
You can only target an opponent who is in active physical control of the puck. You cannot check someone who just passed the puck a second ago, and you certainly cannot check someone who is skating up the ice waiting to receive a pass. That is interference.
Target must have the puck. Check. Number 3, direction.
The geometry of the hit is strictly regulated. You must deliver the check from the front, diagonally from the front, or straight from the side. You are never, under any circumstances, permitted to deliver a check from behind.
Direction is front or side. Check. Number 4, the surface area of the hitter. This is a massive one regarding biomechanics.
When you deliver a check, you must use your trunk only. That refers specifically to your hips and your shoulders. You cannot use your hands to shove them. You cannot use your forearms, your stick shaft, or your elbows to deliver kinetic force. If you extend your arms outward to push a player off balance, that is an illegal hit, usually called for roughing or interference.
Trunk only. Check. Number 5, the contact area on the receiver. Where am I legally allowed to strike them?
The impact must occur within a very specific window, above the opponent's knees and at or below their shoulders. Any contact to the head or neck area is strictly penalized, and leading with your knee to strike their thigh or knee, known as kneeing, is incredibly dangerous and results in majors.
Between the knees and shoulders. Check. And finally, number 6, the tell. How does a referee watching the game at high speed instantly know if I am throwing a legal check or about to commit a penalty?
Proper legal checking technique always starts with your stick actively playing the puck. As you glide into the hit, your stick blade should be down below your knees, on the ice, sweeping toward the puck.
But if it's up?
If a referee sees you skating toward an opponent along the boards and your stick is raised up in the air near your waist or chest, they instantly know you are not trying to play the puck. You are almost certainly about to commit a cross check, or your elevated arms are going to cause head contact. Stick down, elbows tucked tightly to your ribs, and drive the shoulder through the center of their chest.
I found something really interesting while poring through the rule books for this. If you look at USA Hockey or Hockey Canada, they lay out that positive framework explicitly. They tell you exactly what a legal check is.
Right.
But if you read the NHL rule book, they actually lack a comprehensive, positive definition of a legal hit. They don't have a specific paragraph outlining perfect form. Instead, the NHL defines a legal check entirely in the negative. They just list all the specific ways a check is illegal, like boarding, charging, or elbowing.
It's a fascinating difference in legal philosophy. The amateur books are designed to teach the game, so they provide an instructional framework. The NHL rulebook is designed purely for arbitration among professionals, so it relies heavily on established precedent and defining infractions.
That makes sense.
But the practical takeaway is that relying on the USA Hockey definition is the best practice for any player. If you stay within their strict framework, trunk only, stick on puck, hitting solely for possession, you will never violate the NHL rules either.
Let's do another retrieval question for the listener to test how these physics apply to the rulebook. We have all seen the play. A defenseman winds up from the center red line, builds up maximum speed, and absolutely obliterates a forward who is standing still on the half wall.
Ouch.
The crowd goes wild, but the referee's arm shoots straight up in the air. What exact physical metric defines a charge?
Charging is fundamentally a calculation of distance traveled and the kinetic energy built up to deliver the hit. It isn't just about how hard the hit is, it's about how much ice you use to accelerate into it.
How many strides is that?
The specific metrics vary slightly by jurisdiction. USA Hockey defines charging as taking more than 2 strides to accelerate through a check. Hockey Canada defines it as taking 2 or more strides. The IIHF uses a slightly more subjective phrase, calling it multiple strides.
So essentially, if you are winding up from 30 feet away, you have already committed the penalty in your setup long before you ever make physical contact with the opponent.
Exactly. You have weaponized your momentum beyond what is required to separate them from the puck. And it is worth noting that jumping into a check, where your skates leave the ice before impact, is universally defined as charging in every single rulebook on the planet, regardless of whether you took 1 stride or 10.
Okay, this brings us to the most vital pivot of this entire discussion. We've talked extensively about how to dictate space, how to strip the puck, and how to deliver a hit. But what if you are the one carrying the puck?
The receiver.
Yeah. What if you are digging in the corner, you hear the heavy scrape of skates closing in on you, and you know you are about to get hit? This is Section 5, Survival on the Ice. And I want to flag this clearly for everyone listening. If you only remember one section of this deep dive, make it this one. This is about keeping yourself out of a wheelchair.
There is no hyperbole there. We are talking about the biomechanics of spinal injury prevention. And the foundational doctrine, which is preached across every hockey program in North America, is summarized in 4 words. Heads up, don't duck.
We need to explain the physiological why behind this, because simply telling a teenager not to duck isn't enough. Understanding the anatomical mechanism of why ducking is fatal is what actually overwrites human instinct and changes behavior.
Let's look at the anatomy of the neck. When you are skating in a normal athletic hockey posture with your head up looking forward, your cervical spine, the vertebrae in your neck, has a natural backward-facing C-shape curve. In medical terms, this is called cervical lordosis.
Okay.
That curve is an evolutionary masterpiece. It acts as a built-in shock absorber. If you take a force to the head, that curve allows the spine to flex and disperse the kinetic energy safely into the heavy muscles of your shoulders and back.
But the danger arises when we change that posture. What happens when a player looks down at the puck at their feet or tucks their chin toward their chest in anticipation of a hit?
When you flex your chin toward your chest by just a few degrees, that natural shock-absorbing curve is entirely removed. Your cervical spine straightens out. The vertebrae stack up perfectly vertically, bone on bone, like a straight stack of wooden blocks.
And when you have a perfectly straight spine, and you are pushed headfirst into the unyielding wall of the boards,
the physics become catastrophic. The impact against the board stops your head instantly. The velocity of your skull goes to zero. But your body, carrying perhaps 180 pounds of mass and whatever momentum you had, keeps moving forward.
Oh, man.
Your torso acts like a massive hammer driving straight up into that straightened stack of vertebrae. The force cannot be dispersed by a curve, so the bones themselves take the entire load. This is called axial loading.
Axial loading.
Yes. The vertebrae compress and shatter, driving bone fragments into the spinal cord, resulting in severe compression, permanent paralysis, or worse.
And the chilling fact, confirmed by USA Hockey's medical research, is that this axial loading fracture does not require the massive kinetic energy of an NHL player skating at 25 miles per hour.
No, it doesn't.
The engineering limits of a straightened human spine are frighteningly low. They state clearly that this specific compression fracture can occur at walking speed.
That fact should completely rewrite how every player views the boards. Let me repeat it. Walking speed. There is absolutely no speed slow enough to make a head-down, head-first collision with the board safe.
Wow.
You cannot rely on the fact that you play in a slow beer league to protect your neck. You must fight the instinct to look down, keep your head up, and keep your chin off your chest.
Which flows directly into the second core concept of survival, which also requires fighting human nature. Never turn your back.
When a human being sees a physical threat rapidly approaching, millions of years of evolution scream at them to flinch, to turn away, and to present their back to protect their vital organs in the chest and stomach.
Right.
In life, that is a protective reflex. In hockey, when you are standing 2 feet from the boards, that reflex is a death sentence.
Because turning your back exposes that vulnerable spinal column to the incoming force, and legally, it instantly turns what would have been a standard legal shoulder-to-shoulder body check into a hit from behind.
And hits from behind are treated with zero tolerance across all global rulebooks. If you forcefully check an opponent from behind into the boards, you are almost always looking at a match penalty, which triggers an immediate ejection and a subsequent disciplinary suspension.
And I'll mess around with that.
The rulebooks are merciless on this specific play because the player receiving the hit from behind is entirely defenseless. They cannot brace their musculature to absorb the blow.
I can guarantee some of our listeners are formulating a very specific, cynical question right now. Someone is thinking, you know, wait a minute. If checking from behind is an automatic major and an ejection, what if I'm carrying the puck, I see their star player coming to hit me, and I deliberately turn my back at the very last millisecond? I'll draw the penalty and get their best guy kicked out of the game.
That is the most dangerous calculation a player can make. First of all, from a pure risk-reward standpoint, you are risking lifelong paralysis for a two-minute power play. It is sheer lunacy. But secondly, the NHL and IIHF rulebooks have explicit language to counter this exact manipulation. They state that if a player intentionally turns their back at the last moment to artificially create back contact, the checking from behind penalty is completely waived.
Oh, wow. So the referee will not call it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You gain absolutely nothing strategically, and you risk your ability to walk.
So we know we can't duck, and we know we can't turn our backs. How exactly should we absorb an impact against the wall? Our sources lay out three specific geometric cases for meeting the boards. Case one is the ideal best-case scenario.
Case one relies on your skating route. It is arriving on an angle. You deliberately dictate your path so that you do not intersect with the boards perpendicularly.
Okay.
You skate in on a sweeping arc, scoop up the puck, and keep your feet moving parallel to the wall. If a checker does make contact with you, your momentum is already moving alongside the boards, meaning the force is absorbed as a glancing blow along the glass rather than a dead stop impact smashing you straight into it.
But case one isn't always available. What if the puck is dead and stationary, right on the dasher board? You get there, you stop to play it, and you hear the footsteps coming. You know you are about to take a heavy hit. This is case two.
In case two, survival depends on your edge work. You must immediately get both of your skates parallel to the boards. You want to take the incoming contact entirely side on.
Side on, right.
You press your forearm, your upper thigh, and your hip firmly against the boards to eliminate any gap. You bend your knees deeply to lower your center of gravity, widen your base, and physically lean your weight into the impending impact.
I'm going to stop here for some critical myth busting. A lot of well-meaning old school coaches will yell from the bench, you know, take the wall on your shoulder. Give them the shoulder.
And modern sports medicine tells us that is the exact opposite of what you should do. Do not take the wall on the point of your shoulder.
Why not?
The shoulder is a complex, relatively fragile joint. Hitting the hard tip of your shoulder directly into the unyielding plexiglass is a primary mechanism for collarbone fractures and AC joint separations. You want to absorb the force using the widest, most padded surface area possible, which is the long bone of your forearm and the dense muscle and padding of your hip and thigh.
Okay, case three. This is the nightmare scenario. You are facing the boards, completely perpendicular to them. The puck is in your skates. You are about to get hit squarely from behind, and you realize you literally do not have the fraction of a second required to turn your skates parallel. What is the emergency protocol?
You have to act instantly to spread the mechanical load. First, ensure your head is up and your chin is actively tucked back away from your chest.
Good.
Then, bring both your stick and your gloves up high and press them flat against the plexiglass. You want to keep your elbows slightly bent. You're essentially turning your arms into progressive shock absorbers. As the hit lands on your back, your arms will compress, bleeding off the kinetic energy before your torso slams into the wall. This isn't about winning the puck anymore. This is pure, desperate damage limitation.
And despite all these precautions, despite perfect rules and perfect posture, hockey is a chaotic, high-speed collision sport. And catastrophic accidents do happen. So we must cover the medical protocol.
Yes, we must.
If there is a horrific collision along a wall, a player goes down on the ice and they are complaining of neck pain or numbness, or if they are unconscious, what is the absolute first non-negotiable rule for everyone else on the ice?
Nobody moves them. Under no circumstances do you try to help them sit up, and you certainly don't try to help them skate to the bench. You do not touch their helmet. You immediately stop play, wave over the medical staff, and call for an ambulance.
Because if a player has a fractured cervical vertebra, any twisting or lifting motion can cause the bone fragments to sever the spinal cord. They must be immobilized, exactly as they lie.
Precisely.
And what if the impact involves the head, but the player doesn't lose consciousness? They take a heavy hit to the jaw, they stumble a bit, but they get up, they skate over to the bench, drink some water, and tell the coach they just have a slight headache or a ringing in their ears. Can they take their next shift?
Absolutely not. If a concussion is even remotely suspected, the player is permanently removed from the ice for the remainder of the day. And here's the critical part. Even if they sit in the locker room for 20 minutes and tell you that their headache is completely gone and their vision is clear, they cannot return to play.
Because concussion symptoms can be delayed.
Right. Yes. And the risk of second impact syndrome, where a second minor head trauma occurs before the brain has healed from the first, causing fatal brain swelling, is just too severe. They must remain out until they have formal medical clearance from a qualified professional. And importantly, you never let a concussed player drive themselves home alone.
That is heavy, but it is unequivocally the most vital information we will discuss today. Okay, let's take a collective breath. We've established how to survive the initial impact along the wall. But hockey is about possessing the puck.
Right.
How do we transition from merely surviving the hit to actually winning the puck after the collision has occurred? This takes us into section six, in the trenches. We're going to deconstruct the three distinct battle zones on the ice, the boards, the corners, and the net front.
These three zones represent completely different ecosystems. Each one requires a unique mental model, specific geometry, and a different tactical approach. Let's start with board battles. This occurs when the puck is pinned dead against the straightaway sideboards. The overriding principle here is straightforward. Arrive first and establish your body securely between the opponent and the puck.
Because once you establish that position, it becomes a game of leverage, right? Mm-hmm. We're not talking about pure upper body bench press strength here. A smaller player can absolutely dominate a massive player on the wall.
Exactly. Leverage will defeat pure strength in a board battle 9 times out of 10. The mechanics of leverage require a wide, incredibly low base. Your skates should be wider than your shoulders, your knees must be deeply bent, and your chest should be up.
So you want your center of gravity to be physically lower than your opponent's center of gravity.
Right. If you are low and anchored into the ice, and a bigger player comes in standing upright with stiff, straight legs, you will effortlessly push them up and out of the play.
And once you are locked in that physical stalemate, grinding against each other on the wall, what is the secret weapon to actually extract the pucks from the pile? Because your arms are usually tied up.
The secret weapon is your feet. In a protracted board battle, your upper body is heavily engaged in maintaining leverage, and your stick is likely pinned or tied up by their stick. But your skates are free.
Oh, okay.
Elite players use the inside edge of their skate blade to subtly kick the puck backward to a supporting teammate waiting just outside the scrum.
I do need to inject a severe warning on that tactic, though. You use your skate to manipulate the puck, but you must never, ever kick at a player. Kicking an opponent with a skate blade is universally classified as a match penalty, meaning an immediate ejection and a police-level suspension across all rule books.
Wow.
The skate blade is a weapon.
Here, true.
Okay, moving down the wall, let's talk about corner battles. How does the ecosystem change when we reach the curvature of the ice?
A corner battle is a board battle, but the introduction of the curve alters the geometry and the tactics significantly. First, because you are at the intersection of the sideboards and the endboards, the puck carrier has multiple escape routes that can go up the wall or behind the net. Second, defensively, corner battles are tactically designed to be engaged as a two-on-one scenario.
Right. This is the classic first man in, second man in concept that coaches preach. Break down this specific job description of the first man in.
The first man in is the disruptor. Their sole job is to engage the puck carrier, take away their speed, and seal them off to stop the puck from moving. But here is the critical legal nuance that many players miss. As the first man in, your objective must be to pin the puck, not the player.
Explain the difference. What does it look like when someone illegally pins the player?
If you skate into the corner, completely ignore the puck at their feet, wrap your arms around their torso, and squeeze them into the glass to hold them there, that is a holding penalty or an illegal body check. You are not making a hockey play.
Wow. Okay.
In women's hockey, under IIHF Rule 101.1, pinning a player against the boards is explicitly outlined as an illegal maneuver. The puck must remain the sole active object of your physical engagement. You use your body to stop their progress while your stick battles for the puck.
Okay, so the first man in engages the puck and stops the momentum. What is the role of the second man in?
The second man must stay OUT of the pile. This is where amateur teams hemorrhage goals. Two teammates will both dive aggressively into the corner, get their sticks tangled up with one opponent, and completely abandon the defensive structure,
leaving the slot wide open.
Exactly. By committing two bodies to the corner, they leave a second opposing forward standing completely wide open in the high slot. The proper tactic is for the second man to stay 3 or 4 feet away from the scrum, read the angles, anticipate where the puck is going to squirt out, and immediately jump on the loose change.
I love that discipline. Okay, let's move to the most brutal, unforgiving trench of all. Net front warfare.
Ah.
You are a defenseman standing in your goalie's crease. A massive opposing forward comes down and parks themselves right in your goalie's eyes, hunting for a rebound. What is the defensive strategy?
The ultimate goal here is the box out. It is functionally identical to rebounding in basketball. You do not want to stand behind them and push. You want to fight to get your inside shoulder ahead of theirs, pivot, and place your hips squarely between them and the puck, holding your ground so they cannot reach the rebound.
But the forward isn't just going to let me stand there peacefully. They're going to be hacking and slashing with their stick to get position.
Which is where the stick battle occurs. As the defender, you must neutralize their weapon. You use a heavy stick lift or a stick press to tie their blade up low near the ice. What you absolutely must not do is succumb to the temptation to cross-check them violently in the lower back.
Let's do some more myth-busting here, because this causes so many arguments in beer leagues. I have heard players literally scream at officials, you know, "Ref, my blade was flat on the ice, so I was just pushing them legally. That wasn't a cross-check."
That is complete, utter folklore. Having the blade of your stick touching the ice does not magically render a cross-check legal. The rulebook definition of a cross-check is using the shaft of the stick, held between your two hands, to forcefully deliver a check to an opponent.
So the location of the blade is entirely irrelevant.
Entirely. The force is being transmitted through the shaft into their spine. It is a severe penalty in every league, and if you strike a player up high near the neck, or if the cross-check causes an injury, the referee will escalate it to a major and a game misconduct. You must tie the stick. You do not cross-check the spine.
Okay, so if I am forbidden from cross-checking them, how do I physically uproot a 220-pound forward out from in front of my goalie?
You employ a leverage maneuver called walking them out. You get your shoulder underneath their armpit to establish low leverage, widen your stance, and use your leg drive to physically walk them away from the crease.
But there are some caveats there, right?
Yes. Two massive caveats to this technique. First, physically forcing a player out of a space is only legal in a full-checking league. If you attempt this forceful eviction in a non-checking league or in women's hockey, you will be penalized for interference or an illegal body check.
And the second caveat concerns the physical geometry of where you walk them, correct?
Yes, and this is a paramount safety issue. When you walk a player out, you must steer them sideways, out toward the corner boards. You never, under any circumstances, walk them horizontally across your own goal mouth.
The risks there are astronomical. First, if you push them forcefully across the crease, you run the risk of shoving them headfirst into the metal goalpost.
Right.
The post is an unmovable object, and we are right back to that walking speed spinal compression fracture we discussed earlier. Secondarily, from a tactical standpoint, by pushing them across the crease, you are physically dragging a massive human screen directly across your own goalie's line of sight, blinding them to the shot.
Exactly. You are aiding the offense while risking catastrophic injury. So let's categorize the mental models for these three battle zones for you listening to ensure they are locked in. Boards equal leverage and feet, corners equal puck focus, and the discipline of the second man staying out, net front equals the box out, tying the stick, and walking them safely to the corner.
Perfect categorization.
Yeah.
Which transitions us smoothly into section 7, discipline. Because winning the physical battle, possessing the perfect angle, and executing the flawless stick lift means absolutely nothing if you end up sitting in the penalty box, or worse, injured on a loose puck because you lost your tactical composure.
Let's look at the chaos of loose pucks, or what coaches call 50-50 races. This is when a puck is chipped into open ice and a forward and a defenseman are both sprinting for it.
These races are incredibly dangerous because both players are accelerating toward a collision point. The guiding philosophy for elite players in the 50-50 race is arrive early, decide late. I love that phrase. It means you shouldn't go flying into the engagement area at 100 miles an hour, fully committed to a desperate, lunging poke check before you even know what the opponent is doing.
Precisely. It is about maintaining your decision-making capacity. If you lunge at full speed, you are completely unbalanced and committed to one physical outcome. If the puck bounces or if you miss, you go sliding out of the play and you expose your head and ribs to a massive collision.
Okay, so what's the alternative?
Instead, you want to use your speed to win the race to the area, then immediately slow down into a wide balance stance. You establish your body position between the opponent and the puck, read their momentum, and then decide what tactical maneuver to execute.
And once you secure that puck on the half wall, you essentially have two main escape routes to relieve the pressure. You can either rim it or you can reverse it. How do you decide which to use?
Your decision is dictated entirely by reading the momentum of the incoming checker. If the checker approaches under control and is coming straight at you, attempting to physically seal you against the wall, you rim it, meaning you send the puck hard forward along the curvature of the boards in the exact direction you were originally skating.
But what if they come in too hot?
If the checker is aggressively overcommitting and flying past your inside shoulder to try and cut you off, you reverse it, meaning you quickly bank the puck backward off the boards into the empty space they just vacated.
It's all about reading the pressure and exploiting their momentum. Now let's talk about a different kind of discipline, shot blocking. Stepping in front of a frozen piece of vulcanized rubber takes serious guts, but there is a medically correct way to do it and a way that will shatter your bones.
The absolute first law of shot blocking is proximity. You must get as close to the shooter as physically possible.
Why is that?
The closer you are to the blade of their stick, the more of the physical net you take away geometrically. And, crucially, the less time the puck has to accelerate to maximum velocity or alter its trajectory.
And you generally want to remain on your feet if possible, correct? Sliding on your stomach looks heroic on television, but it's risky.
Yes. A standing block keeps your skates under you. If the shooter fakes the shot or if the puck hits you and drops to your feet, you are still actively in the play. When you block from a standing position, you must square your body entirely to the shooter. You want to present only your heavily padded surfaces to the puck, meaning your thick shin guards, the heavily padded front of your hockey pants, and the solid chest protector.
What are the absolute, non-negotiable, never-do-these rules for shot blocking?
The most common and dangerous mistake is turning sideways and lifting one leg up, which players colloquially call the flamingo.
The flamingo. I've seen it 100 times in adult leagues. The guy gets scared at the last second and contorts his body.
It is entirely understandable. Human instinct demands that you turn away from a 90-mile-an-hour projectile. But by turning sideways, you expose the completely unpadded back of your calf, the vulnerable back of your knee where crucial arteries and nerves run, and your unprotected ribs. It also turns your head, blinding you to the rebound.
Right.
The second absolute prohibition is never leading with your stick.
That seems counterintuitive. Why wouldn't I want to use my stick to deflect the puck away from my body?
Because the angles work against you. A puck that hits the rigid shaft or the angled blade of an outstretched stick very often ramps sharply upward, deflecting the puck directly into your own face or throat. You must keep the stick flat on the ice to seal the passing lane or pull it entirely out of the shooting lane.
Oh, wow. That is terrifying.
And finally, from a pure tactical standpoint, you must never attempt to block a shot on a two-on-one rush.
That is defense 101. If you are the lone defenseman defending a two-on-one, your sole responsibility is to take away the pass to the open man. You must trust your goalie to take the shooter. If you drop to your knees to block the shot, a smart puck carrier will simply feather a pass right over your body to their teammate for an empty net tap-in.
Exactly. Tactical discipline. The final piece of this section is the discipline required to avoid major penalties. We've discussed the technical fouls, but we need to address the emotional ones. First and foremost, retaliation.
It is the oldest cliche in sports. The referee always catches the second guy.
It is a cliche because it is demonstrably true. If an opponent chops you behind the play and you lose your temper and chop them back, you have just committed a massive tactical error. You have turned a single penalty on them, which would have given your team a power play, into coincidental minor penalties, wiping out your team's advantage. Emotional control is a tactical weapon. Walk away and take the power play.
The next emotional flashpoint is face masks and helmets. When a scrum breaks out after the whistle, hands tend to get high.
And this is where players get themselves suspended. If you grab an opponent's cage or face mask, you are done for the night. In amateur rules, this isn't just a polite two-minute minor like it sometimes is in the NHL. The amateur rulebooks recognize that grabbing the face mask provides horrific leverage over the cervical spine. It is an automatic major penalty and a game misconduct, and if the referee believes there was intent to injure, it escalates to a match penalty. Keep your hands down.
And what about slew-footing? We hear this term a lot when a play looks particularly dirty. This is when a player comes up from behind, kicks the opponent's skates out from under them, and uses their upper body to pull the victim backward.
Slew-footing is arguably one of the most predatory and dangerous plays in the sport. Because the victim is pulled backward while their feet are swept forward, they are completely unable to use their arms to break their fall. The inevitable result is that the back of their head is whipped violently directly into the ice. Because of the extreme risk of severe concussions and skull fractures, slew-footing is never a two-minute minor. Under NHL rules, it is an automatic match penalty. Under USA Hockey and IIHF, it is a major and a game misconduct at minimum. You must never place your leg behind an opponent's leg during a physical battle.
And the final piece of discipline, leaving the bench or the penalty box during an altercation.
This is non-negotiable. If a fight or a scrum breaks out on the ice and you are on the bench, your feet stay glued to the floor. Leaving the bench or the penalty box to join an altercation, even to act as a peacemaker, is an automatic major and a game misconduct under USA Hockey, and an automatic suspension under NHL and IIHF rules. Let the officials handle it.
The architecture of this game is incredibly deep when you pull back the curtain. We've journeyed through the matrix of rules, we've broken down the exact physics of angling and stick checks, we've outlined the rigid escalation to legal body checking, we've explored the anatomical realities of surviving a hit, and we've mapped out the trench warfare of the boards and the crease.
To solidify all of this into a permanent, working mental model for our listeners, we need to synthesize how an expert actually organizes this information in real time. Beginners view physical play simply as hitting. They view it as a series of isolated, violent collisions. Experts do not see it that way. Experts view physical play as a fluid hierarchy of spatial control.
Which fundamentally shifts how you approach defending. It's an intellectual process, not just a physical one. If I'm synthesizing the core tenets we've covered today, that hierarchy begins entirely off the ice. You must first map your boundaries by checking your specific league's checking rules in writing. Because age and division are never enough to assume you know what game you are playing.
Once on the ice, the first step in that hierarchy is taking away their space. You angle first, always approaching with your momentum, heading back toward your own net, dictating their path to the boards without committing to crossovers.
And once you've trapped them, you take away their weapon. The stick lift is your master tool for stripping the puck safely, relying on leverage rather than force, but it must be executed meticulously below the bottom hand to avoid high-sticking a bent opponent.
Only when you have exhausted those tools, and only if your league permits it, do you escalate to taking away their body. A legal check is a precision instrument, delivered trunk on trunk, with your stick definitively on the puck, targeting only a player in active control, with the sole purpose of gaining possession.
And when the roles are reversed, and you are the one under attack, survival demands overriding human instinct. You never turn your back to the boards. You take contact side-on, absorbing it with the wide surface of your forearm and hip, not the fragile point of your shoulder. And above all else, heads up, don't duck, because tucking your chin straightens the cervical spine and turns a simple board collision into catastrophic axial loading.
And should the worst happen, the absolute final rule of safety is immobility. If a player is down with a suspected neck injury, the helmet stays on, the body remains untouched, and the paramedics are called.
I want to leave you listening with a final provocative thought to mull over before your next game or practice. When you are a beginner, or even an intermediate player who hasn't mastered these mechanics, the ice rink can feel incredibly small. The boards feel like a dangerous magnetic hazard. The corners feel claustrophobic and chaotic. But once you truly internalize and master the mechanics we discussed today, how to angle flawlessly, how to manipulate your center of gravity, and exactly how to position your skeleton to safely receive kinetic energy, a remarkably strange thing happens. The physical dimensions of the ice actually start to feel bigger.
That is a profound psychological shift. You move from a state of anxiety to a state of control.
Because when the sheer animal fear of unexpected collision is removed by proper biomechanical positioning, your brain stops worrying about basic physical survival. That immense processing power frees up. You stop bracing for impact, you stop rushing your decisions, and you start looking for the next pass. You start processing the tactical geometry of the game at a higher elite speed.
You transition from merely surviving the game to actively dictating it.
Exactly. So the next time you watch a game, look past the beautiful, sweeping, open ice passing plays. Look deep into the corners. Watch the players who consistently win those scrappy 3-second contests. Watch their edges. Watch the height of their stick blades. Watch their hips. Because now you know the mechanics behind the grit. That is where the game is actually won.
Thanks for diving deep with us.